arrows, no sharp objects. I promise.
I was asking him to go if tomatoes would stain this jacket, and I said probably because it's wool. Let me get these slides back. Jack revealed my surprise slide there. That was it. And apparently, I'm going to encourage you to please silence your phones, because that's sitting there. Let me go back one more. Okay, there we go. Well, good afternoon. It's been kind of a long day for me. I had to get up pretty early to get here from Memphis. So if I do nod off during this presentation, that's probably an indication of how exciting it is. Thanks for having me. I was asked to come here today to discuss the Cotton Research and Promotion Program. I'm going to be very happy to answer any questions that you have that I can't answer. Please feel free to interrupt me. My presentation is listed as a conversation, and I certainly hope we can achieve that. But I did prepare, about 30 slides, so, a conversation peppered with slides. A little bit about myself, just so you know, I have actually been president and CEO of the Cotton Board for coming up on, it'll be 4 years in October. I graduated from law school from the University of, I was raised on a small farm in North Mississippi. I graduated from law school from the University of Georgia. I worked in Washington, D.C. for almost 10 years. I spent almost five with the Department of Agriculture and the General Counsel's Office, and I spent over five as senior counsel of the Senate Agriculture Committee back when we wrote the 1990 Farm Bill. So if there's anything in there that you don't like, unfortunately, I'm probably responsible for it. Because I was an attorney. I didn't do the votes, but I wrote a lot. I put a lot of ink on paper during that process. After in 92, I left Washington and I moved to Memphis and I became general counsel of the National Cotton Council. I stayed there for 10 years and then I was, as a friend of mine there said, I was in-house counsel for the Cotton Council for 10 years and out-house counsel for another nine. So I did it from the private perspective for 9 years until I was asked to come become president and CEO of the Cotton Board over 3 years ago. So I've watched these programs, to be honest, for the course of my career, I've watched these programs from very, very many different angles. And it's only been really since the last 4 years that I've actually been inside these programs as opposed to outside these programs previously. And the presentation I'm going to give to you today, number one, let me say this. I have never had an hour on a program. Never. Nobody who knows me would ever give me that much time on a program. So I'm going to apologize in advance. But we will take our time, and I have tried to put, as usual, probably more detail here than I should. But this is also largely not that much of a variation on a presentation I would do if I was speaking to the Mississippi Farm Bureau, or if I was speaking to Tennessee Farm Bureau, which I do, every third year or so, I rotate through the regional cotton folks and I give a report from the Cotton Board and I kind of tell them about this program and what it does. So the large portions of what I'm doing here today are very similar to those presentations. And given that intro too, I better be sure I read this paragraph, which says, I cannot evaluate whether a similar program will be beneficial for hardwoods. I am very positive about Cotton's program. As you will see, it has a very long evolution and specific reasons for its existence and specific reasons that it's structured the way that it is. It has its own story. Now, I include vision in the title of this because I must have missed that slide. I include vision in the title of this because cotton industry leaders from the 1960s saw their industry in serious decline, and they took steps in the 1960s to fight back. It was their vision in constructing and committing to this program that helped cotton remain an economic fixture in the United States, I sincerely believe. Their vision and commitment helped cotton provide economic returns to their families and to the communities that they were raised in, and to a generation of new cotton producers that are out there today. And there's a very strong link to those people. So my surprise slide. I'm not a complete stranger to hardwoods. I have helped cut them, sawmill them, plane them, turn them into fences, bridges, barns, and even furniture. I was raised on a small farm in North Mississippi, and although my dad did not cut very many trees, he loved to push them over. He owned a bulldozer, and that was his recreational activity. You're laughing, but I'm really serious. And guess what my recreational activity was? Picking up chunks. Everybody knows what picking up chunks is? Okay, that's when you pick up the loose wood that's left after my father has raked the land free of trees. But he liked to drive the bulldozer. He liked to push down trees. And since we had trees now that he pushed over, he set up a sawmill on the farm, and we used those trees in, of course, every capacity that we could. So I've turned a few in my day. And at some point, I had the good sense to take just a couple pictures. These are about the only pictures I have of that sawmill, because I was always working. I wasn't taking pictures. These days, my favorite hardwoods are the ones that are usually used on guitars. I tend to follow, therefore, the more exotic species of hardwoods from that angle. It's a hobby, and I really like it. But all my life, I love wood. I love woodwork. It's something that I did with my father. I know you do other things, but it has an emotional connection to me, just like cotton does. This chart shows one vision of the history of cotton for the past 50 years. For 40 of the past 50 years, U.S. per capita cotton consumption has been our primary indicator of the cotton program's success. It was a bumpy ride during the program's early years. Demand turned the corner in the 1980s and reached 36 pounds per person at its peak. No other country's per capita consumption of cotton is even close to the United States. My little story I tell at this point is that 1976 low point was the time I graduated from high school. Some in this audience will remember what we were wearing in 1976. And my senior year in high school, they introduced the casual photos. You know, instead of just the tuxedos, you could come in and have a casual photo taken for the yearbook for the seniors for the first time. And my English teacher was in charge of organizing that for us, and she announced one day that she wanted all the boys to wear leisure suits and the girls to wear, and I don't remember what she said the girls to wear, but all the men to wear leisure suits, and I had to go up to her after class. Or actually, I raised my hand and said, Ms. Singler, I don't own any leisure suits. Those things are made out of polyester. My father grows cotton. That's not something I do. And she said, well, what are you going to wear? You got to wear one. I said, well, I was thinking about maybe a navy blazer. And she said, what do you want to do, look like a truck driver? So that's where leisure suits were in 1976. And you know, that we kept going down until 80 when we turned the corner on per capita consumption in the United States, and the program got going. I'm not going to get into all the intricacies of that, but if you think about the program starting, you know, essentially in the late 60s, it didn't turn things around overnight. It took a long time to get some traction and get going. Now, there's a correlation between these two slides. We're a little bright on these slides. Can y'all see that okay? There's a correlation here. This is the level of funding that has gone into the Cotton Research and Promotion Program since its inception. Initial funds under the program essentially began to be collected and spent back in 1968. New referendums were approved in 1974. Further expanding the assessment program and growing resources. And in 1991, as the program expanded beyond cotton producers to encompass imports of cotton-containing products, the market was changing dramatically in the 1980s, with imported apparel coming in at record amounts. So they went in for amendments in the 1990 Farm Bill. They changed the assessment schedule, so we assess both, and I think I repeat this ad nauseum later on, but we expanded the assessments to include the cotton content of imported products. At that point, within just a year, receipts into the program grew to $60 million, and now it's about an $80 million program. Now, it's been $80 million for several years here, and you know, as inflation grows, we have not been able to probably keep up with inflation for the last 7 or 8 years. Okay, before I go further, because I am going to do a little bit of history here today, so I want to clarify the three central organizations in the U.S. cotton industry, and I've got mine up there as one of the top three, so I'll go ahead and admit that. The National Cotton Council, which is, again, I was general counsel there for 10 years, that is a voluntary trade association. It conducts political and policy activities and some market development activities and some research for the industry. It was founded back in 1939. It's a relatively unique organization. I'm always proud to have been a part of it. It has seven segments in it. People who are in the National Cotton Council go from the grower of the cotton all the way up to the point where the textile, somebody in a apparel mill puts a pair of scissors to a piece of fabric, and the Cotton Council stops at that point. So within that organization, you have people who want cotton to be expensive, and you have people who want cotton to be cheap. And so it's always been interesting to watch them work together. And it took them a long time to get there, but it's a very consensus-oriented organization that functions as the central organization for the U.S. cotton industry. All right, so that's number one. Number two is Cotton Incorporated, which is a nonprofit corporation. It actually was founded in Tennessee. And it was originally established by the National Cotton Council, actually with another name back in the 1950s, and I'll bring that timeline up here in just a minute. The third one is the Cotton Board, which is the one of which I'm the president, and is a quasi-governmental organization that was formed by the Cotton Research and Promotion Act to carry out the research and promotion program. And my little colors really have faded on this, but this is an attempt at a timeline to kind of go over this process. In the 1950s, the National Cotton Council, again, as the central organization, knew that we were losing markets. There were a lot of things that needed to be done. So they took about three or four stabs at purely voluntary dollar a bale campaigns, they called them, back in those days, to raise money to promote cotton. They did it two or three times over the years. They formed and essentially organized something called the Cotton Producers Institute, again, this nonprofit corporation, to carry out that activity, to do both research and promotion on cotton uses across the United States. Ultimately, the leaders of the Cotton Council decided that they weren't doing enough. So they got together and they went to Congress in 1966 and they passed the Cotton Research and Promotion Act. At the time, I think it's either the first or the second, what has come to be known as commodity checkoff programs that was ever put forward in the United States. It was a standalone piece of legislation. They essentially wrote it themselves and wrote it in whole cloth, but they did it, you know, for the purpose of helping their industry. Let me catch up on my paper here. Polyester, the main driver here, of course, was polyester that had come into the markets in the 60s. There were big companies that had big dollars that were promoting that product, and that's what those cotton producers in Mississippi and all across the southern United States knew that they were facing and knew that they didn't quite know how to face. So, first the National Cotton Council, then the Cotton Producer Institute voluntary campaigns. 1966, they passed the Cotton Research and Promotion Act. A referendum was conducted up under that. It was voted in. The order was passed, and so the Cotton Board then was established with the passage of the Act. The Cotton Board is the entity that collects the money and then pays the money out for the program. It essentially oversees the operations. I'm going to step through all this. The interesting thing about cotton is that, again, that Cotton Producer Institute was sitting there, and so the industry wanted the effort that they had made in that and the people they had associated with that to continue to be responsible for implementing this program. So the statute itself sets up a sole source contractor for this program. That sole source contractor was the Cotton Producer Institute, which then morphed over into Cotton Incorporated. The statute says how, you know, the board of directors, where they come from for Cotton Incorporated, they're cotton producers. They come essentially from the same organizations that come up with the nominees for my board of directors. But they are different. And so the Cotton Incorporated was in place when we passed the Research and Promotion Act. Once monies begin to be collected, Cotton Incorporated is our sole source contractor. I collect money, my members oversee the operation of this program. Cotton Incorporated is the organization that implements it and carries it out. 1990, I mentioned a minute ago how the funds had increased in 1990, and it's at that point that the Cotton Research and Promotion Program also became mandatory. When they brought in imports, they also made the assessment mandatory across the board because they knew they wouldn't collect any money from imports on a voluntary basis. So they had to make it mandatory for the import side, which they had to treat everybody the same, so they had to make it mandatory on the producer side as well. This is our structure. Again, I'm being a little redundant, but just to make it clear, because I don't take some things for granted. USDA oversees everything, the order and regulations they wrote and are responsible for. The Cotton Board, us, we collect, we have oversight, and we provide communications about what this program is doing back to the stakeholders, not to potential consumers, but back to the stakeholders. And then Cotton Incorporated, again, the nonprofit corporation, implements this program on behalf of the industry. Our mission, the Cotton Board's mission, is to serve U.S. producers and importers of cotton and cotton products by effectively and efficiently governing the research and promotion program so that it leads to increased demand and consumption of cotton. And one thing I will tell you is that the mission that we have and the mission that Cotton Incorporated has drives what we do. And we have internal discussions sometimes, because I was in one about 2 years ago, because some of my members wanted to push a certain expenditure of money, and Cotton Incorporated came back and said, okay, just tell me how that's going to sell a bale of cotton. And that stopped it, because it wasn't. It was going to make people feel good. So the people, my volunteer leaders, take that mission very seriously, and they work within those parameters. Okay. Just quickly, the Cotton Board itself, my organization, consists of cotton producers, representatives of apparel brands and retailers, and two consumer advisors. So the apparel brands and retailers now are the people who import products that contain cotton into this. So on my board, in addition to producers from all across the Cotton Belt, I have representatives from JCPenney, from Target Incorporated, from Avon, from Ralph Lauren, for example, Jones of New York, other people who know they're out in the market, they know what's happening. They're on my board. They, interestingly, are not on Cotton Incorporated's board. That's all producers. But again, they're stakeholders in this program now, and that's why they're on the board. Okay, so cotton producers, representatives of apparel brands and retailers, and two consumer advisors. Our members are nominated by certified interest organizations and annual caucuses, essentially state organizations. But they're ultimately appointed by the Secretary of Agriculture. Appointments are for a 3-year term, and right now we have 76 on our board. We have both members and alternates. So for every member slot we have an alternate coming behind them, and that's why I have a total of 76. I think that's it. Our activities are routinely overseen by the Department of Agriculture. The Cotton Board breaks out its responsibilities into three primary functions. There's a fiduciary component that focuses on the full and accurate collection of assessment funds and on ensuring that those funds are spent in compliance with law. To me, that's, because of the way we're structured, because I have in Cotton Incorporated, this entity out there that's doing the implementation, for me, day to day, that fiduciary component is my number one thing. I mean, funds come in, funds get taken care of, funds go out, everything is documented, everything is audited, everything is clear. That's goal number one. That's my responsibility number one, is to take care of the money. We also have oversight and administration component to ensure the activities undertaken by Cotton Incorporated are in furtherance of the program's mission, so we don't just hand the money over. I'll get to that in a minute. And then thirdly, as I said, we have an obligation to communicate to the stakeholders about what this program is doing. And I will tell you that our primary communications are back to producers as opposed to the importers. Cotton Producer collects assessments from U.S. cotton producers and on the cotton content of imported textile products. Assessments are usually paid by first handlers of U.S. cotton and by importers. Customs actually collects our assessments at the border and just sends us a check. These assessments pay for the work of Cotton Incorporated. They pay for the administrative costs of the Cotton Board, my organization, and they pay for the administrative costs of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Every year, the Cotton Board writes a check. We write a check to USDA. But they have one or two staff that are primarily responsible for overseeing our program, and we fund their salaries, or fund the portion of their salaries that's attributable to us. So there are no taxpayer dollars involved in this program. And actually, when the government shut down last October after some circling the wagons and trying to figure it out, the people who work on our program stayed at their desks because we were paying their salaries. Notice here, too, that dollar a bell thing that I mentioned is still in this program. It's never going away. Now, there's also a supplemental assessment now, and I've always wondered, why is it 0.5%, which is, of course, 0.5%. But I think over the years, when it started, I think it may have been 0.3%, and as it bumped up to 0.5%, they just left it that way. So it's been here for really as long as I can remember, and I started work for the Cotton Council in 92, so it's been at this level for at least 20 years. And you can see our budgets. In 2013, we had $83 million that we put into program activities with Cotton Incorporated. In 2014, we had to cut that number back to $80 million. The Cotton Board, to accomplish our oversight of the program, we have four program committees, so I'm going to get a little bit now into the actual meat of what we do. We have four program committees that correspond to our several mission areas, namely agricultural research, consumer marketing, global supply chain marketing, and research and development. So these are the four primary things that we look at from a component basis every year. The Cotton Board and Cotton Incorporated conduct joint planning each year. I just concluded the first meeting of 2014 in March with the Cotton, and the Cotton Board developed its initial strategic recommendations for the 2015 budget year. So we put those together. We were in Santa Fe. We were in those separate program committees. We listened to reports. We considered economic things around the world, and we developed a list of recommendations. They developed a list of recommendations that then I'm responsible for forwarding. Cotton Incorporated, now this is this circle here. Cotton Incorporated takes those recommendations, they review them, and they develop a draft budget in June. They have a meeting in June to go over their draft budget. And then in August of every year, both organizations get together and we finalize the budget. So this August, 2014, we'll finalize the budget for the 2015 program year, so a year out. Well, in June, also, we go over, that's when we do our auditing cycles. We're both on a calendar year fiscal. Our fiscal year is a calendar year. We conduct auditing and everything else in June, and we have to be audited in accordance with USDA requirements. Then in December, we have a final meeting of both groups where we look back on the current program year. So last December, we actually met here in Savannah, and we took a look at everything that had happened in 2013. And by we, I don't mean me, I mean the volunteers of the Cotton Board and the Board of Director members of Cotton Incorporated. Now, with this light, I'm not sure you can see a thing. And I will tell you, if my staff ever put up a slide like this, I would give them grief, a serious grief. So, of course, I did it, but they haven't seen it, so I'm safe. I was sitting at home, and I just kind of added this at the last minute because I was trying to think, you know, the areas I put out there are pretty obvious, but it's not so obvious as to everything that connected up under that. I did see in Mike's presentation today so many of the same things that we have to connect through. I mean, that's all stuff, you know, that we worry about all the time. But we're conducting agricultural research at seed, input levels, everything else for those growers to worry about how much it costs to produce cotton. We're also worried about the strength of that fiber, technical aspects of that fiber, what it can do. And then there are researchers at Cotton Incorporated that are looking at that fiber and they're researching aspects of that fiber, trying, you know, if it spins this way, what does it do? If it spins that way, what does it do? What does that variety do? What does this variety do? They're all doing that all the time. And that's, you know, they do that in ag research, but there's ag research and there's also fiber research that takes worried about that strength from the farmer's perspective, what he gets in value, but then worry about how value that particular piece of fiber is to the spinning mill when it gets it. And so they're trying to develop different aspects of that fiber for them. Within Cotton Incorporated's headquarters in Cary, North Carolina, they have essentially many textile mills there. They have many spinning facilities. They have printers. They do colors, everything else for fabric all the time because they, within that headquarters, they're basically taking the raw material. They're trying to turn it into something that's going to be valuable for the downstream buyers. And then they try to convince those downstream buyers that this is something you need to get into your set of markets. This is something that's going to be money for you. They do deal in fashion, so you know they worry about color and everything. You know, this year's color may not be next year's color. People at Cotton Incorporated, there's a team there that actually worries about that every year. And when they figure out from the fall fashion shows what the next color is, then they go back to the cotton yarns and try to figure out whether the cotton yarns can get that color so that it's going to be right there for the fashions and hit the front row center and be selling things at the retail market. So I tried to draw this, you know, just to indicate how many things overlap from a yarn spinner to fabric manufacturer to the brand and retailers who are telling us what they want and then who we're also trying to convince them what they want, and down to the retail consumer, which, of course, we're all trying to convince them what they want. And then back from textile processing, how much water? We talked about environmental issues. Sometimes it takes a lot of water in a textile manufacturing operation. We have programs trying to design to cut down on the amount of water, finding new ways to get indigo out of denim or get indigo into denim. For example, ag research, cotton fiber research, product development and testing, cottonseed research. Product development testing, one of my more controversial committees. I have on that committee a couple of representatives of brands here who are very much in touch with what's happening in Europe. They're very much aware and scared, or just say aware, of what non-governmental organizations and the demands they put on retailers and others in the marketing chain. So something you're doing today that's okay, you know, Greenpeace tomorrow may come up and say, "Nah, we don't think that's okay anymore," and it only takes one or two retailers for them to get on that bandwagon, and then poof, you've lost the market. Suddenly, wrinkle-free cotton may be at risk because of the things that are used on cotton to make it wrinkle-free. Oxfam put out I think it's Oxfam. Don't hold me to who it was. Either Oxfam or Greenpeace, two of my favorite organizations, put out a publication recently about the monsters in your child's closet. And it's talking about the garments that they have and the processes that are used on those garments. Now, they didn't just single out cotton, fortunately. They were actually pretty honest. They kind of popped it across the board. But still, those are the things that we worry about. And we have researchers right now trying to move from this chemistry to that chemistry, from this thing to that thing, in anticipation, you know, of that guillotine, if you will, getting dropped somewhere down the future. Okay. Here's my little part of this slide. The manufacturer of rayon and polyester, the DuPonts of the world, develop their fiber, they create new products, and they work to enhance the end uses of their fiber. Kenneth Hood, a very good friend of mine, he's a very large cotton producer in the Delta in Mississippi. I know Kenneth, I think, runs over 10,000 acres. He's the most progressive cotton producer I know. He has come up with technologies to enhance his cotton production that you, quite frankly, might not believe what he's developed on his farm outside of Cleveland, Mississippi. But he doesn't work with spinning mills. He doesn't work with fabric manufacturers. He doesn't work with Under Armour. He grows and gins cotton. For Kenneth and every other independent cotton producer, Cotton Incorporated and the Research and Promotion Program are his corporate development arm for his raw material. And we are effective because we get Kenneth's resources and we pool it with the resources of every other cotton producer and the importers in the United States. Okay, a slide maybe you can read. Our annual program budget is carefully considered and reviewed. This is from the 2014 budget book that we looked at last year. It's broken out, again, I told you those primary areas between consumer marketing, supply chain marketing, product research and development, agricultural research, administration, and about 7 years ago, they added this strategy and metrics pie into this chart because as the importers came in, they basically said, in our companies, we do a much better job of reviewing who we're trying to sell to, what they feel, what they need, than you are. You need to get on the stick. So we added that wedge, and we've got people that are devoted to that now. Every year, as I said, the Cotton Board and Cotton Incorporated, they break this budget out in all budget documents with increasing levels of specificity. I know this is not very readable. I'm just trying to give you an illustration. This is kind of a top line page out of the budget document. And then the budget document contains priority issues for the program. So, you know, not exactly within each kind of budget area, but priority issues. And if you can't read these, for example, they've got water, as a key external issue here, or restrictive substances in textile processing, what I was just mentioning a minute ago, U.S. machine washing restrictions. Okay, you, Mike, you said some things you're worried about coming down the line. We're all kind of concerned about in, think about 5 years, the amount of water that's going to go into your washing machine is not going to be very much. And we're concerned about what how that's going to affect your shirts, how it's going to affect your pants when they go through a situation where they really don't probably don't have enough water to wash out the soaps that we're using right now. What is that going to do? Rising farm production costs, and I think for this year that's bumping up the line, and then innovative products. This is just one page. There's probably 4 or 5 pages of these priority items. Every 5 years, by statute, we have to hire and conduct an independent economic review of our program. That's been ongoing for a long time, but the 1990 amendments, the ones that actually wrote the generic promotion program provision, which I think is what your program is being structured under, those provisions require this 5-year economic review. So what we have done in the past, the last two times, we've hired several economists, one with Texas Tech, I think, and two with Texas A&M, where they have some very sophisticated econometric models with respect to agriculture. And we hire them and they conduct an economic review, basically using econometric models. Now, I will tell you, these reviews are very positive. What are the numbers here? About every dollar invested, about $9 to the producer, and every dollar, about $15 to the importers. In terms of, so that's a 1-15 ratio and a 1-9 ratio. Those are very good numbers. But even those numbers apparently don't reflect the value of the ag research in particular, because the economists have told us over and over again, they don't really have an econometric model that can do any good at all evaluating the long-term impact of agriculture research. It's very hard for them to do. You know, when you get that good variety, it's just something they just cannot plug into their econometric models as well. So this is probably understated for producers. The accomplishments of the program are legion, from wrinkle-resistant finishes in the 1960s to 100% cotton wrinkle-resistant shirts in the 90s. Module builders were invented in 1971 and with assistance from Cotton Incorporated, and they transformed the way cotton was harvested. There's something called Easy Flow Cottonseed, and there are a lot of other advancements in cottonseed that make it a more valuable component of the cotton production. The seal of cotton was introduced in 1973. The Fabric of Our Lives campaign, which you all, I'm sure, know of, was started in 1989. Trans-dry cotton is a very recent innovation assisted by Cotton Incorporated, and it brought Under Armour into the cotton market for the first time, the company who for 10 years said cotton was the enemy two years ago started saying, well, you know, maybe we like it. And now they're making cotton products and producing them, and they've been very, very good sellers for Under Armour. In 2013, Cotton Incorporated organized the second 24-hour runway show in Miami, which featured 1,440 fashion looks over a 24-hour period. The first fashion, they did one down there 2 years ago. It was pretty good. The one they did in 2013 was a smashing success. People Magazine ran it on their website. It was I don't know what this means exactly either, Jack, but it trended on Twitter. And clothing stores in Los Angeles were offering 24% discounts over the 24-hour period of the fashion show, and they reported huge sales increases. I mean, it's a splash thing, but it's a splash thing at the demographic that our consumer campaign is targeting, women of this age. It's hard to imagine our cotton industry without any one of these innovations. It's very hard to imagine. Since its inception, the Research and Promotion Program has been accountable for its stakeholders' investment. I believe that we have a very good report card. Over 70% of consumers say natural fibers are better quality. More consumers believe cotton and cotton blends are best suited for today's fashions than any other fabric. Cotton is the favorite fiber to wear. Clothing that clearly labels and identifies cotton products are more influential to consumers' purchase decisions than clothing that is using environmental claims. I just really got this slide about 2 weeks ago, and I still haven't digested this because a lot of our priorities in our budget discussions are about environmental claims. But it is pretty amazing that 100% cotton beats out sustainable right now in the consumer's mind by a pretty wide margin. You would think wood would do that for plastic too. at least, or for metal or concrete. I would. Over the past several years, consumers have consistently described cotton apparel as comfortable, natural, and environmentally friendly. More than 9 out of 10 consumers say cotton is safe for the environment, and that's been consistent over time. And significantly, we own one of the most trusted, widely respected, and well-known brands in the world in the Seal of Cotton. More than 8 out of 10 consumers recognize the Seal of Cotton. Actually, I think it's ticked up over 90%, but I think it's fallen just under it here in the last year. Now, through Cotton Incorporated, which is what I essentially just went through, the programs that Cotton Incorporated carries out, they communicate the message about cotton to consumers, retailers, brands, spinners, fabric manufacturers, and all other potential users of cotton. We play another vital role in communication as the Cotton Board by communicating to stakeholders, the people who pay into the program, about exactly what the program is doing and how their funds are being spent. All of our contributors, every stakeholder, is of equal importance to our efforts. There have been no serious internal challenges to the Cotton Research and Promotion Program, as far as I know, mainly because of its results, but also because I think we strive to ensure that all stakeholders have a sense of equity in the program. You know, you really do have to have two things. You have to have results over a long term, people who are patient to wait to get them. But you know, even with those results, you have to have a sense of equity. Everybody involved has to believe that, you know, this is working for everyone's interest, and they're all equally participating in the burden, and that they'll all participate in the profits that come on the other side of it. It's key, and it's hard to obtain. Annually, we conduct field tours. We bring representatives of brands and retailers to cotton fields. We talked about cutting down those trees. Now, people don't understand, but, you know, it's pretty good to get young buyers, people just out of college, moving and working for Jones of New York or whatever, riding cotton pickers over in Arkansas. It's a very good experience, and it works very, very well. We also bring cotton producers to Cotton Incorporated's Cary, North Carolina headquarters to let them see what their money has bought there. It's quite a facility in Cary, and of course, it didn't happen overnight either. Then, I also believe that a critical factor in our success is the investment the industry has made in people over the past 40 years. The Cotton Board is in the middle of an award-winning ad campaign directed to cotton producers, drawing a link between their support of this program and the dedicated professionals at Cotton Incorporated, who eat, sleep, and fantasize about cotton all day, every day. Now, do you believe I fantasize about cotton? I do. I fantasize about cotton, but, you know, I was raised on a cotton farm, so what else am I going to do? But this kind of expertise and insight not only takes time to develop it, but it takes dedicated, voluntary leaders who are committed to long-term planning and long-term solution. And they get dedicated to people like these four people that I've got up on screen. And I will tell you, these are outstanding individuals. I've got another picture in a minute, but Cater Hake there, the kind of the ugly guy with the light shirt over there, hope he hears that I called him ugly. But I did a little cotton tour with Cater over in southern Kansas. They are growing cotton in Kansas a year and a half ago. And I mean, those cotton producers, you know, I was the president of the Cotton Board, but they wanted to see Cater. We walked out in cotton fields. Cater pulled up cotton plants. We looked at roots. They wanted to see Cater. They wanted to hear what he had to say. What does Cater have to say about my cotton and about the number of seed I've got in my bowls and where this crop is going? What has he got to say about the tillage practices that I've got and the water that's going on here? And so he's kind of a rock star, and that's good. He should be, because he cares about what's happening on all those farms. Leadership and dedication have made the Cotton Research and Promotion Program successful. Our board members take their responsibilities seriously, and they do believe they can make a difference. As the CEO of the Cotton Board, it's my responsibility to ensure that board leadership is empowered and in control. I may work diligently to organize and educate, but my board members prioritize and evaluate. If I didn't have it that way, they wouldn't keep me. But if they didn't have it that way, the producers wouldn't keep the program, because they know whether the program is following their interests. The Cotton Board and Cotton Incorporated remain committed to a broad vision for the future. We do have a successful program, but we are only as successful as last year's numbers. We are presently facing significant challenges. Per capita consumption of cotton is dropping in the United States. I showed you the chart earlier. China policies are tending to favor man-made fabrics over cotton. Cotton's world market share has dropped since the 2008 thing took the wind out of us. The members of the Cotton Board work to find ways to stop this slide. Now, these are the current members of the Cotton Board, and in this little picture, I have them staring straight at that critical per capita cotton consumption chart. I show this picture to each new set of board members when we do orientation every year to remind them of their task and the challenges that they face. Jack? How long have I gone? Long enough? You would think I'd know that. That's actually kind of a hard question to answer. Gross sales of cotton, to be honest with you, I think more in terms of bales. I've often thought more in terms of volume. It's from the years, basically being the lawyer, I left the dollars to other people. We've had basically, in terms of consumption in this country, we've had a consumption of cotton that ranges between about 19 to 22 million bales of cotton. We often talk about a $50 billion industry, I think, total. Now, that's coming from the production values that are ascribed, the ginning, the cottonseed, the apparel end products. And then when I say consumption of about 21 million bales, know that I'm talking about there's cotton going out, there's cotton coming in. So, but disappearing within the United States because of what consumers buy, it's about 21 million bales. We're not producing 21 million bales right now. We're producing in the area of about 18.
Is that about $650 a bale?
When you add, that's the raw product wouldn't be that valuable, but when you add all the downstream value to that product, that'd be about right.
And the government provides subsidies to cotton growers to a certain extent as well?
The cotton program is out there, yeah. And it's, yeah, been there since the 40s. Now, it changed a lot this time, and they're about to go through, they're moving more to crop insurance this time, so they've got a shakier stand.
I can answer that. Actually, I participate in that, and it's going away. It's not as big as
you. It's coming down.
It's coming way down.
Yeah. But I have friends at the National Cotton Council. I'm not going to let you say it's going away. Because they'll get drugged through the streets on with cords, but it's undergoing a radical transformation, and those kind of subsidies we've been used to are shifting, and they're moving primarily over to a crop insurance based system. There was another one. Sorry about that, Jack. I got to protect my friends. No, it's not. We have the opportunity. We actually don't have a revote. We have an opportunity for a revote.
Can you speak about some of the arguments maybe of the inequity of people involved in that, like this guy pays more, this guy pays less, this particular? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I do, and to be honest with you, I can only speak poorly to that. We have an opportunity for revote. If 10% of the folks out there, and I think it's, well, the secretary goes out every 10 years, but if 10% of the people, you know, who the stakeholders want to cause a referendum vote, then they can bring that to the secretary and the referendum vote would be held. I think I read over yours quickly. I think yours actually has at least the proposal has a vote in it every so often anyway. Well, we don't have that. You have to get more than 10% to request it. I get just no equitable arguments. Everybody seems to be very content with the way the assessment goes. That 0.5%, like I said, that added value assessment has been sitting there for the 20 years, I believe, that I've been working, you know, outside of Washington in cotton. It hasn't moved up or down. It does move as the value of cotton goes up or down. That thing tracks down. The importers, the formula there is they're assessed at a rate that's supposed to be equivalent to the rate of assessment that's happening for the producers. So their rates also move up and down in terms of what happens at the farm gate value of cotton. Sure.
So do you feel like in general the people that are in the cotton industry really are really pleased with the benefits of the program?
I will tell you, that's way understated as far as I'm concerned. Our big stumbling point was when the importers came in 1990, they weren't very happy, and they started having to pay, and then they walked to the first meetings, and the producers basically looked at them and said, well, thank you for your money. You can go over to the corner of the room now, and we're going to conduct our program. You're laughing, but that's really kind of what happened. And the importers over about 4 years said, we're kind of big CEOs and senior executives of companies, and we don't like getting treated that way. But it took about 8 years. But 8 years went by, and they broke all that down. So now I've came into a board that's got great working relationships. The producers on my board protect the opinions of the importers and retailers because they value them because they're outside of the box that they live in. And so, and I don't have anybody on my board complaining about assessments. I will say this, I forgot about this, that two years ago, the Department of Agriculture did a kind of a revamp of the way it was handling the customs, the tariff schedule items as they were coming in. And whereas the assessment had focused on a narrow range of about 220 items, which is, you know, let's just say 89% of all cotton that comes into the United States, an attorney probably said, well, you know, that's a great focus, but the statute says we get them all. So they went from like 227 items to about 1,050 for that remaining, you know, 4 or 5% of value. And that was implemented at the same time that a value increase went into effect. So we had some bumps from some importers at that particular point in time. But it smoothed on out. Again, we've been doing this thing since 1968. So they've had a lot of bumps through what they consider equitable and what they don't consider equitable. And a lot of those things have kind of gotten worked out over time. I mean, if you don't work it out, then the program goes away. If you don't maintain equity, you don't keep it. Yes, sir. No. No, and we're probably worse than that a little bit. It's not relevant to the cotton producer. But again, our assessment is leveled on essentially the raw cotton production. Now, we usually pull that money at the gin or the merchant level, but it's based on that raw cotton production, so it's out right there. It's not supposed to be assessed again. Okay? Now, we also assess the cotton content of imported cotton apparel.
Imported from other countries.
That's right.
U.S. companies?
Yeah. If they bring it in and it's got, if it comes under a tariff heading that's got cotton in it, custom grabs some money and they drop it into my pocket, just to be blunt about it. Actually, they won't let me touch it. Actually, there's a... there's a locked up box out there that the money goes to. I barely even get to smell it as it goes by. Well, let me keep on my importer thing. You talked about deducting, you know, the value. Now, the importers can't deduct anything. Now, ostensibly, what they can do is come in and say, we just brought our stuff in from Colombia. The mill that we do our business with there in Colombia participates in NAFTA, and they buy all their cotton products from the United States. Because it's been so long since a referendum has been conducted, they've actually did it two different ways. The first referendum that they did in 68 had kind of a dual thing. Either three-quarters of the producers who were voting could accept it, or a majority of the production plus a majority of the producers. So there were two kind of possibilities in that 1967 vote. The 1990 vote just says a majority. It's actually pretty vague. Again, they were bringing in importers at that point in time. So you had all these producers who were looking at $20 million. So they said just a majority vote.
Majority of producers or majority of?
Everybody who, all potential stakeholders, a majority. So everybody who's going to pay in. So we don't, our program, I think as I recall, now correct me if I'm wrong, there are exemptions. You have a lot of kind of de minimis exemptions. The cotton program doesn't have any of those exemptions. So,
so the guy that did 20 acres had the same vote as the guy that had 100,000 acres?
In the one that, although I cannot imagine there was any 20 acre producers in 1990, but yeah, that was 1991.
What percent of the cotton harvested in the United States is subject to this assessment?
100. Well, wait. Organic, there is an organic exception. I'm sorry. 99. Which, by the way, I horribly disagree with the organic exemption. There are just some things you can't get into an argument about rationally. When this started this past year, I asked the Ag Research Cater, I said, how many ag research projects do you have ongoing that you're monitoring every year at various universities and stuff across the South? He has about 440. And I said, of those, how many of those, you know, would actually contribute to help organic producers of cotton? And he came back and he said 370. And so, I mean, anyway.
Is consumption per capita the primary metric y'all use?
Probably not anymore.
Well,
we look at consumption per capita in the United States because, as I showed you, at 36 pounds a person, it was such a strong indicator. And, you know, and the Fabric of Our Lives campaign, you know, those ad campaigns, they're happening on the TVs, the social media thing here with this country. And so we drove that demand. I think the program can take credit for driving that demand up into the up to 36. I think Europe at the time we were 36 was like 19. I mean, and then, you know, developing countries and all other countries about 6. I mean, that's a hell of a disparity. Okay, so we still look at it because it's such a factor to tell us how we're working here, you know, and we've been poop like that since 2008. We've got to at least pop that and kick it. 36 pounds may not happen again, but, you know, give me 27, give me 28. Externally, world market share. We look at percentage of imports. I think that last slide I showed you was basically the percentage of cotton imports coming in several categories. You know, you'd look at golf shirts, you would look at certain women's blouses, you would look at certain trousers, products that are primarily cotton, look at what's happened to those. So that's an area. But world market share, we can track world market share, and we basically track it as opposed to polyester. Because that, you know, polyester, that man-made thing out there, is in all honesty our primary competitor.
I tell you what, Bill, we're going to go ahead and break into the round table.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I think we can ask you 101 more questions, so I think we're going to break into something smaller.
I've only got 14 more answers.
Is that it? Well, that's not enough, because I think there's going to be 101 more questions for you. All right, thank you. I appreciate your time.